Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, we explore new options in cardiovascular prevention, fish oil supplementation in dialysis patients, RSV vaccination, and cutting-edge cellular therapy for leukemia. We discuss advances in lung cancer treatment, approaches to functional dyspepsia, and a complex case of severe infection after travel. Perspectives examine access to and cost of weight loss drugs, the promise and risks of AI in clinical care, and what it means to care for others while carrying personal loss. A new Clinical Decisions asks, which would you choose, transcatheter or surgical aortic valve replacement? This feature about a woman with asymptomatic severe aortic stenosis offers a case vignette accompanied by two essays, one supporting treatment with transcatheter aortic valve replacement and the other supporting surgical aortic valve replacement. Visit NEJM.org to vote and to see how others chose. Evolocumab in patients without a previous myocardial infarction or stroke by Erin Bahula from Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston, and co-authors. The proprotein convertase subtilisin cexin type 9 PCSK9 inhibitor evolocumab reduces the risk of major adverse cardiovascular events, MACE, among patients with a previous myocardial infarction, stroke, or symptomatic peripheral artery disease. This study evaluated the effect of evolocumab on the risk of MACE among patients without a previous myocardial infarction or stroke. More than 12,000 patients with atherosclerosis or diabetes and without a previous myocardial infarction or stroke who had a low-density lipoprotein cholesterol level of at least 90 milligrams per deciliter were randomly assigned to receive evolocumab or placebo. PCSK9 inhibition with evolocumab led to a lower risk of first cardiovascular events than placebo among these patients, with a 25% lower risk of the primary composite of death from coronary heart disease, myocardial infarction, or ischemic stroke, and a 19% lower risk of the expanded primary composite endpoint, 4-point MACE, which included ischemia-driven revascularization. Chadi Ndumile and Roger Blumenthal from the Johns Hopkins Chicherone Center for the Prevention of Cardiovascular Disease, Baltimore, write in an editorial that these findings from the trial by Bohula and co-authors represent an important step forward in clinical knowledge. Although PCSK9 inhibitors had been shown to reduce the risk of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease events among patients with previous myocardial infarction or stroke, this new trial has found that PCSK9 inhibition conferred clinical benefit in patients without previous myocardial infarction or stroke. It is also important to recognize what the current trial does not tell us. Because combining generic high-intensity statin therapy and ezetimibe leads to an LDL cholesterol level below 70 milligrams per deciliter in the vast majority of patients with a baseline LDL cholesterol level of less than 160 milligrams per deciliter, it was the recommended initial strategy in the 2018 Multi-Society Clinical Practice Guideline. However, only 20% of the patients in the current trial were receiving ezetimibe. Whether similar clinical benefits would be observed in a population of patients receiving more aggressive treatment at baseline with less residual atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk is unclear. Nevertheless, the investigators should be applauded for this landmark trial. Fish oil supplementation and cardiovascular events in patients receiving hemodialysis by Charmaine Locke from the University of Health Network, Toronto, and co-authors. Cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death in patients receiving hemodialysis, yet effective preventive therapies remain limited. Supplementation with N3 polyunsaturated fatty acids, especially eicosapentaenoic acid, EPA, and docosahexaenoic acid, DHA, may have cardiovascular benefits in the general population. But efficacy among patients receiving hemodialysis is uncertain. In this trial conducted at 26 sites in Canada and Australia, 1,228 adult patients receiving maintenance hemodialysis were randomly assigned to daily supplementation with fish oil, 4 grams of N3 polyunsaturated fatty acids, or corn oil placebo. The rate of serious cardiovascular events among participants receiving maintenance hemodialysis was lower with daily supplementation with N3 fatty acids than with placebo. In an editorial, Finian McCausland from Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston, and David Sheraton from the New York University Grossman School of Medicine ask, should fish oil now be recommended for our patients receiving hemodialysis? On the one hand, the reported differences in cardiovascular risk are impressive, with upper boundaries of 95% confidence intervals well below unity. So it seems unlikely that these findings are due to chance. Given the lack of efficacious therapies in this population, clinicians may feel compelled to strongly consider recommending the use of N3 polyunsaturated fatty acids in their patients, even in the absence of a significant difference in all-cause mortality. On the other hand, contemporary medicine is replete with examples in which potentially practice-changing, outsized results of early trials have failed to be replicated. This situation suggests that we should pause before accepting the remarkable results reported by Locke and co-authors as gospel. Issues related to generalizability and a lack of mechanistic understanding of the findings warrant caution. A confirmatory trial is certainly indicated. RSV prefusion F vaccine for prevention of hospitalization in older adults by Mats Højbjerg Lassen from the Copenhagen University Hospital, Herlev and Gentofte, Denmark, and co-authors. Respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, can cause serious illness in older adults. The bivalent RSV prefusion F protein-based vaccine, RSV Pre-F, has been shown to prevent RSV-associated respiratory illness, but data from randomized trials with regard to its effect on outcomes involving hospitalization are limited. In this pragmatic Phase 4 trial with individual randomization, 131,276 participants, 60 years of age or older, were assigned to receive RSV Pre-F vaccine or no vaccine during the 2024-25 winter season. The RSV Pre-F vaccine, as compared with no vaccine, reduced the incidence of hospitalization for RSV-related respiratory tract disease, as well as the incidence of hospitalization for respiratory tract disease from any cause, among adults 60 years of age or older. Universal base-edited CAR-7 T-cells for T-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia by Robert Chiesa from the Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children, NHS Trust, London, and co-authors. These authors previously reported results from a first-in-human study of an investigational therapy consisting of universal base-edited anti-CD7 CAR T-cells that were infused in order to secure deep molecular remissions of refractory T-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia, ALL, prior to allogeneic stem cell transplantation. The investigators now report results of the completed Phase 1 study. Universal base-edited anti-CD7 CAR T-cells were administered to 9 children, as well as to 2 adults who were treated under compassionate use access arrangements. The investigators found that the investigational therapy induced anti-leukemic responses in all the patients with relapsed or refractory CD7 T-cell ALL who received treatment. 9 patients underwent allogeneic hematopoietic stem cell transplantation while in deep remission. 2 patients with quantifiable minimal residual disease in bone marrow received palliative care. Limitations of this therapy included CD7 antigen loss and risks of viral-related complications.
I'm Darren Teichman, a deputy editor at the New England Journal of Medicine. I've been a full-time medical journal editor for over 15 years, but I've never stopped seeing patients. Just like the other full-time physician editors on our team, I continue to practice medicine for a couple of reasons. Most importantly, I love it. It's who I am. It's who I trained to be. I've known many of my patients for over 20 years, and I don't want to lose those connections. I also think seeing patients makes me a better editor. When we sit around the table and discuss papers, my colleagues and I can understand why the questions asked by the research studies we're considering are important or not to practicing clinicians because we see patients ourselves. I love this work because I always learn a lot. And the goal is simple: to help our authors clearly, honestly, and concisely communicate their findings to our readers so they, in turn, can use what they read to help their patients. It certainly helps me take better care of my patients. We're published by the Massachusetts Medical Society, a not-for-profit publisher, and we rely on subscriptions from individual readers, medical schools, and libraries to fund what we do.
Functional Dyspepsia, a review article by Pankaj Pashrika from the Mayo Clinic, Scottsdale, Arizona, and Nicholas Talley from the University of Newcastle, New South Wales, Australia. Functional dyspepsia is a common but serious medical syndrome that can induce weight loss and food aversion and may be associated with increased risks of hospitalization and death. Functional dyspepsia probably comprises several different and yet incompletely characterized disorders. Patients with local mucosal microinflammation driven by an aberrant Th2 response may represent an important subgroup. There is overlap with other gastrointestinal syndromes, particularly irritable bowel syndrome and gastroesophageal reflux disease, and patients with overlap have more severe symptoms. There is no approved drug for functional dyspepsia. Treatment is empirical and directed at symptoms and consists of acid suppressants and low-dose tricyclic antidepressants and other neuromodulators, along with appropriate nutritional and psychological support. A 50-year-old woman with fever and abdominal pain. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Stephen Threlkeld and colleagues. A 50-year-old woman was admitted to the hospital because of fatigue, diarrhea, leg pain, headache, and chills after returning from a trip to remote northeastern Brazil. The patient had acquired schistosomiasis as a child in Brazil. The infection had been complicated by portal hypertension and hypersplenism. On current arrival in the emergency department, the patient was hypotensive, febrile, and tachypneic, with hepatosplenomegaly and petechiae. Imaging revealed cirrhotic liver changes, esophageal varices, pulmonary infiltrates, and a large uterine fibroid. She rapidly deteriorated into refractory septic shock with disseminated intravascular coagulation and multi-organ dysfunction. The bacteria on initial Gram staining of her blood appeared to be Gram-positive cocci in clusters. Organism identification performed with matrix-assisted laser desorption ionization time of flight, Malditoff mass spectrometry, showed findings consistent with Neisseria meningitidis. Re-examination of the initial Gram staining and repeat staining identified N. meningitidis. The patient was treated with broad-spectrum antibiotics, vasopressors, steroids, and supportive measures, but refractory shock developed. Invasive meningococcal disease is associated with a substantial public health burden worldwide. In the United States, the incidence of invasive meningococcal disease is highest among infants and young children. However, a growing proportion of cases are occurring in older age groups. Because clinical manifestations of invasive meningococcal disease vary, a high index of suspicion is required. Insurance coverage and pricing of weight loss drugs in the United States. A perspective by Stacy Dusatzina from Vanderbilt University Medical Center, Nashville, and Rachel Sachs from Washington University in St. Louis. On November 6th, the Trump administration announced agreements with Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk regarding pricing and coverage of their glucagon-like peptide 1, GLP-1 receptor agonists, including tirzepatide and semaglutide. The wide-ranging agreements include provisions relating to various segments of the market. Beginning in January 2026, patients purchasing injectable forms of GLP-1 agents without insurance, cash pay, using direct-to-patient sales platforms, are expected to be able to obtain these drugs for an average of $350 per month, rather than the current $500 or so per month, depending on the drug and dose. The lower prices are available only for starting doses. According to a November 6th fact sheet issued by the White House, the companies have agreed to a Medicare price of $245 per month for all injectable GLP-1 agents for currently covered indications, including diabetes, chronic kidney disease, and sleep apnea, and for newly expanded use for obesity and related coexisting conditions. Medicare beneficiaries would have their copayments set at $50 per month for all indications. The announcement also states that Medicaid programs will be able to opt into this price for all GLP-1 agents. In comments to the press, Eli Lilly's chief executive officer indicated that the lower copayments and expanded coverage for obesity indications could take effect in 2026. The new agreements for GLP-1 drugs could reduce prices and improve access for some patients, but will probably also mean that there will be substantial additional spending on these drugs soon. Generic liraglutide, overlooked but not forgotten. A perspective by Suhas Gandhi from Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston, and co-authors. Total U.S. spending on GLP-1 drugs increased by more than 500% since 2018, exceeding $71 billion in 2023. Of this total, $50 billion was spent on two medications, semaglutide and tirzepatide. Rapid GLP-1 spending growth has led payers to raise insurance premiums, impose strict criteria for access, or simply decide not to cover these drugs. Nationwide, spending on this single drug class is contributing to rising health insurance costs that hinder wage growth, slow hiring, and crowd out business and government investment in other priorities. Meanwhile, patent protection for one of the earliest GLP-1 medications, liraglutide, expired in 2024, paving the way for generic competition. Liraglutide was initially approved for type 2 diabetes in 2010 and at higher doses for obesity in 2014. The first interchangeable generic products launched in 2024 and 2025, respectively. The availability of a lower-cost generic GLP-1 agonist presents an opportunity to expand access to this drug class while mitigating the associated financial burden. The market entry of generic liraglutide could meaningfully reduce the fiscal burden of GLP-1 drug coverage, but only if patients, clinicians, and insurers choose to leverage this opportunity. Digital exhaust or digital gold, the value of AI-generated clinical visit transcripts. A perspective by Katherine Goodman from the University of Maryland School of Medicine, Baltimore, and Daniel Morgan from the University of Maryland Institute for Health Computing, North Bethesda. Artificial intelligence, AI, scribes that listen to clinical encounters and generate patient notes are being widely adopted throughout healthcare, with some institutions now using this software for millions of visits each year. To produce a draft note, AI scribes first create an audio recording and a transcript of the patient-clinician conversation. This development is remarkable. For the first time, clinical conversations are being recorded on a broad scale. Because of concerns about medical malpractice liability, however, many U.S. healthcare institutions are deleting transcripts after notes are finalized and aren't receiving audio recordings from AI scribe systems at all. These authors believe this destruction of millions of clinical visit transcripts is unacceptable. It prevents meaningful evaluation of AI scribes. Maximizing the potential of AI scribes requires both increasing awareness of the value of transcripts and addressing legal barriers to retaining them. These authors suggest that clinicians and researchers advocate for the retention of transcripts, that there is a need for formal institutional policy sharing mechanisms, and that healthcare systems could embrace phased-in approaches to transcript retention. My Brother's Sister, a perspective by Nikki Vora from Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston. Every physician has their cry spot in the hospital. Over time, Dr. Vora found her favorites: the hidden bathroom between the 10th floor ICU and the nursing station, the gazebo tucked away in the 6th floor courtyard. But on her first day back on service, she couldn't make it to her cry spot. Dr. Vora hadn't been on service in 2 months, since the day she found out her brother was diagnosed with primary mediastinal B-cell lymphoma. The following few days had been a blur of tests, crying, planning, grief, and hope. After repeated episodes of syncope and convulsions, inpatient chemo was started. Soon, they were managing home chemotherapy, going to the infusion center every day to have the bag exchanged. The lymphoma slowly started to melt away, and they started to breathe again. Suddenly, Dr. Vora found herself back at the hospital, as a physician, not a sister. The weight of her badge, the beeping from patient rooms, the organized disarray felt familiar and foreign at the same time. Interns stood in line waiting to give sign-out. Vincent's a 32-year-old male with primary mediastinal B-cell lymphoma. Unfortunately, his time is short. He probably has days, but he's not imminently dying. You shouldn't have to do anything. Static overtook Dr. Vora's brain. What were the chances that she would be taking care of a patient the same age and with the same rare disease as her brother? She found herself at Vincent's bedside that evening. His condition was deteriorating. His pain was uncontrolled. He was scared. And Dr. Vora was his doctor. She held Vincent's hand. When he slept, she forced herself to leave, but only made it a few feet down the hall before she broke down, sobbing. It is a gritty reality that many physicians will have to confront the very illnesses that affect our loved ones. But at times, feeling and seeing too much isn't a reason to walk away, but a reason to lean in. Because caring for the person in front of you is part of who you are. Because you're needed. Because you understand. In our Images in Clinical Medicine, a 5-week-old boy was brought to the hospital with a painful scalp lump that had been present since birth. On examination, there was a tense, non-pulsatile, round mass on the occiput surrounded by a ring of dark, coarse hair, consistent with the hair collar sign seen with neural tube defects. A diagnosis of atretic cephalocele was made. In another image, an 80-year-old woman presented with a skin lesion on her left arm. Examination showed a brown lesion with eccentric hyperpigmented asymmetrical globules adjacent to a second pink lesion with well-defined borders. A diagnosis of a collision lesion of melanoma in situ and basal cell carcinoma was made. A collision lesion is formed when two or more unique tumors with distinct boundaries occur in the same anatomical location. Collision lesions pose a diagnostic challenge because the clinical appearance of one lesion may mask or distract from the other lesion, resulting in misdiagnosis. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.